Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
This episode of Swindled may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Queest Village, north of Sycamose, is a great place to get away from the big city. A place where crime was almost unheard of until recently. For the past 2 years, the residents have been victimized by a sneaky thief. Dozens of cabins have been broken into, not once, but twice. RCMP believe one man is responsible for all the break-ins. They point to this man, John Bjornstrom, a fugitive who escaped from a Kamloops prison in 1999.
Shuswap Lake, an H-shaped stretch of water in the southern interior of British Columbia, is known as a playground for houseboaters, swimmers, hikers, and anglers. Its four long arms carved through the landscape, drawing visitors in every summer to explore its coves and forested shores. But while the southern reaches bustle with life, the northern half remains largely untouched, silent, remote, and uninhabited. That is, except for the Bushman. Although sightings were rare, the Bushman of the Shuswap was no mythical creature. He was a 39-year-old fugitive named John Lambert Bjornstrom, who had been serving time in prison for break and enter, until he escaped with only 6 weeks left on his sentence. Bjornstrom's uncanny bushcraft and ability to survive the unforgiving wilderness had earned a mix of awe and annoyance among locals. For 2 years, Bjornstrom made the remote Shuswap his refuge, living off the land while supplementing his needs from the cabins that dotted the lake's quieter regions. He would slip inside, borrow food or supplies, and sometimes leave behind polite thank you notes as if he were a courteous guest rather than an intruder. Some residents admired the manners and even began leaving items out for him. Others reviled Bjornstrom for his approach and saw only a two-bit crook who was heavily armed, judging by the weapons that had gone missing. And sometimes the frustration was justified. When resources ran thin, the Bushman resorted to straight-up extortion. He left cassette tapes or handwritten letters with veiled threats for cabin owners who ignored his request for groceries, fuel, or other essentials. Yet, even in these moments, Bjornstrom couldn't hide his courteous demeanor. One bewildered resident told the Globe and Mail that, at the end of a rather threatening tape to my brother, he wished him a pleasant summer and happy boating. Other encounters veered from demanding to unsettling. In one note, the Bushman complimented the family on their children's water skiing, adding, "It looks like they're improving," as if he had been silently cheering from the trees. In another message, Bjornstrom told a woman how much he enjoyed listening to her dinner conversation from just outside her cabin walls. Patience among the locals had worn thin. What began as a peculiar wilderness curiosity was becoming an uncomfortable reality. The Bushman was always watching.
I always feel that there's some eyes peeking through the bush, you know, like when I'm by myself working, I don't like to be alone.
For 2 years and counting, the Sycamus Detachment of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had attempted numerous times to capture John Bjornstrom, but could never find him. The Bushman traveled at night in a black canoe that he submerged underwater during the day, rendering it invisible to anyone passing by. He built hidden treetop outposts throughout the forest, stocked with food, supplies, and binoculars, perfect vantage points for keeping an eye on his hunters roaming below. Bjornstrom later boasted that he even rigged underwater microphones from walkie-talkie parts, giving him advance warning of approaching boats long before they could ever spot him.
There's hundreds of thousands of hectares of bush. We've done aerial searches with our helicopter numerous times. We've been out with our emergency response team doing ground searches, and we've also done boat searches in the area, finding no trace of the man whatsoever.
But there's a Bushman hiding in the shoes, so I don't want no one to find me, so I'll tell him where I am. The Bushman hiding out back. Boom, bubba, wow, bubba, boom, bubba, wow, bubba, boom.
With every month, he remained at large, the Bushman's confidence and infamy grew. Local radio stations played songs about him, and he happily phoned in for interviews. Bjornstrom enjoyed the spotlight, so much so that in November 2001, he agreed to appear on camera with reporter Ted Chernicki of Global News. Bjornstrom dictated the terms, a nighttime meeting at a remote spot near the lake. No surprises, no police.
As darkness falls, we beach and wait, because the Bushman travels only under the cover of darkness, and he only appears after watching us extensively, and until he is sure that the area is safe.
Out of the darkness emerged a short, stocky man with a thick beard, clad in a wool sweater he had stolen from a nearby cabin. He eased into view and calmly took a seat by the campfire in front of the camera, as though he had arranged a casual chat rather than a clandestine rendezvous. John Bjornstrom told Ted Chernicki he understood why some locals despised him, but, he explained, what he was doing was for the greater good. And another point Bjornstrom made crystal clear: he would sooner die in these woods than ever return to prison.
So far, I've actually survived basically on the backs of a lot of the cottage owners. Should I be a cottage owner and suffer the same consequences, I'd be pretty ticked off too. I try not to break anything. I try to avoid as much, least amount of damage should it be, but it's unfortunate, but it is a necessary evil for now. But I am after something that is far greater evil than what I could ever be.
John Bjornstrom's Global News interview not only demonstrated his strengths for living in the bush, but also exposed a weakness that law enforcement seized on, a desire for notoriety. This is Jim Harrison, the RCMP detachment commander in Sikkimis at the time.
What that did do is show us that, he had a weakness, he had an affinity, he wanted to tell his story, and that, of course, led to the actions that we took to capture him.
On November 21st, 2001, the Mounties finally outsmarted the Bushmen. Disguised as a documentary crew eager to tell his story, officers invited John Bjornstrom onto a houseboat for an interview and ended his two-year run as one of British Columbia's most elusive fugitives. As he was escorted back to the dock, Bjornstrom, in typical fashion, had nothing but compliments to offer the police. "It was a good bait," he said. "I have no disrespect for what they did. The police did a good job."
Well planned sting.
The eventual discovery of the Bushman's secret lair only deepened the myth. Chiseled by hand into a rock hillside, his elaborate 900 square foot cave featured working electricity, wood framing and shelving, a greenhouse, solar panels, a hot tub, and a staggering amount of stolen goods. John had a computer, a VCR, a washing machine, a dirt bike, enough guns to start a small army, and a video camera which he used to document some of his adventures.
Oh, take a look down there. Hey man, this is quite a drop here. You want to sneak up on me up here? I'm going to see you.
Prosecutors filed 21 charges against John Bjornstrom, including extortion, assault, resisting arrest, and multiple break-and-enters. He ultimately pleaded guilty to 10 counts, admitting to more than 30 cabin break-ins over 26 months. Concluding that prison would do little good, the judge sentenced John to 23 months of house arrest and 3 years probation.
Well, I'm moving ahead in life. I'm moving forward, making constructive changes.
Bjornstrom resettled in Williams Lake, BC, where he had spent his short youth before leaving town on horseback when he was 14. He served his sentence at his sister's home and made a living driving cargo trucks and a limousine. In his spare time, John panned for gold and volunteered with the Salvation Army. Come December, the ever-bearded bushman donned a red suit to hand out gifts to Santa, embracing his role as a local celebrity. In 2014, the former fugitive even made an unsuccessful bid for mayor.
My name is John Bjornstrom, and I'm running for mayor.
In the years that followed, John's health faltered. Cancer, diabetes, and a string of complications. On the morning of January 13, 2018, neighbors found him face down on the frozen ground. He was pronounced dead at 58. Yet the story refused to end there. The Bushman's shadow lingered in the Shuswap, the questions outnumbering the answers, as author Paul McKendrick, who chronicled the saga in The Bushman's Lair, told Chapters Indigo that the man is gone, but the mystery he built still hums in the trees.
I couldn't explain and just really lingered in terms of what causes someone to walk away from prison when they're weeks away from completing their sentence, to go steal a bunch of stuff and dig out a cave. It just doesn't make sense.
At his 2004 sentencing, John Bjornstrom had offered a motive. Street kids, he said, had told him they were being recruited for modeling. For the Sears catalog or something more nefarious, his lawyer asked. More nefarious, Bjornstrom replied. He claimed that inside some Shuswap cabins, he had found evidence of a child pornography ring, videotapes of unspeakable acts that he had gathered, sealed in a cooler and buried near a lighthouse. He also said he had stumbled across unmarked graves of teenagers and children, even bagging hair samples for the police. Yet despite providing coordinates for the caches, none of it was ever recovered. More evidence, Bjornstrom noted, that law enforcement was involved in a cover-up. Crown prosecutors dismissed the Bushman's tales as wildly delusional and dangerous, and Bjornstrom didn't help his case. In interviews and in court, he repeatedly insisted he had a sixth sense, reinforcing the view that his claims were unmoored from reality.
I have a gift of the psychic ability. Some people will say that's nuts, you're stupid, you're out in the wrong ball field, but I get visions of things of tomorrow today.
It sounds outlandish, but as author Paul McKendrick uncovered, some people seem to take Bjornstrom's claims seriously, including the U.S. government, evidently. In the early 90s, John Bjornstrom had volunteered for a CIA-linked research effort known as the Stargate Project, which had been investigating the use of psychic warfare since the Cold War. Bjornstrom allegedly advanced to a second round before bowing out and returning to Canada, saying the experience left him uncomfortable. Yet he also claimed the test validated his premonitory abilities. Hoping to put those talents to use, in 1995, Bjornstrom launched a new career as a private investigator in Calgary. It was this role that would send the Bushmen into the woods initially. John Bjornstrom says he was introduced to and then hired by a man named David Walsh, the founder of BreeX, a gold mining company suddenly engulfed in global controversy. According to Bjornstrom, Walsh asked him to probe the integrity of his Indonesian operation and the disappearance of the company's chief geologist, Michael de Guzman. Bjornstrom claims he accepted the assignment and quickly stumbled onto what he described as a massive conspiracy, one serious enough, he says, to draw a visit from a group of strong-armed henchmen working for an unknown entity.
Bjornstrom believes he's simply the man who knows too much. 4 years ago, three men came to his Calgary office, beat him unconscious, took his computer hard drive, and all other information about BreeX.
Bjornstrom said he went to the police about the incident, but they could barely stifle their laughter. After that, I got out of Calgary, he later said, to protect himself and his family. The Bushman drifted to the Shuswap and began breaking into cabins to survive. He was soon arrested for the first time and sentenced to 8 months in a minimum security prison, which blew his cover. With 6 weeks left in his sentence, Bjornstrom says he was standing in the prison yard when two unknown men in a truck parked nearby and opened fire. Bjornstrom says he slipped through a hole in the fence and walked 3 days to the Shuswap with nothing but his inmate attire. He's delusional, the Crown prosecutors reiterated, but Dr. Stanley Simrau, a defense-called forensic psychologist, disagreed. Clinical delusions have no basis in truth, he argued, and Bjornstrom's allegations, however far-fetched, did intersect with reality. I happen to believe myself that someone did kill Michael de Guzman, Simrau told the court. I mean, I had some BreeX shares and, you know, I paid a little attention, he said, underscoring his view that, as Bjornstrom alleged, what happened to BreeX was indeed a conspiracy. A tiny Calgary mining company unearths the world's richest gold deposit, igniting a global frenzy of greed, corruption, and mystery on this episode of Swindled.
bribe government officials,
clear violations of federal and state law,
clearly unethical,
pay to play millions of taxpayer dollars that were wasted,
paid tens of millions of dollars,
$1 million,
dummied up its books and records,
by falsifying its books and records,
responsible for the collapse of the entire system,
and in the control of some kind of swindle, etc.
Well, basically, the Briex was a shell of a company with almost non-existent working capital, and I decided to go into Indonesia, and that's where we started from. Just an idea, no money, and a very good geologist.
By 1992, David Walsh was flat broke. The former stockbroker had launched a trust company a decade earlier, just in time for a recession, before careening into oil, gas, and mineral exploration with even worse results. His diamond play in the Northwest Territories came up empty. His Louisiana petroleum claims didn't yield a drop. David and his wife Jeanette were $200,000 in debt, scraping by on her modest secretary's salary and his threadbare day trading wins. Prospects were so bleak that the 1991 annual report for Walsh's basement-run company, BreeX, opened with a reassuring line to its shareholders. Yes, we are still in business. But then, David claims, the answer to all of his problems came to him in a memory. Indonesia. 10 years earlier, he had met a celebrated geologist who swore there were untapped riches in the Southeast Asian country. Walsh spent 2 weeks tracking that geologist down and wrote him a letter. "Dear John, I want to put some romance into both companies," referring to BreeX and its parent entity. Every written profile of John Felderhoff opens the same way. He's a Dutch-born, Canadian-raised, chain-smoking geologist, a true explorer, and a river walker, the last of a dying breed. Felderhoff would spend months at a time in the world's most remote jungles searching for signs of treasure. He'd famously contracted malaria 14 different times. He'd also famously co-discovered one of the world's biggest copper and gold mines in Papua New Guinea, but that was almost 30 years earlier. By the spring of 1993, when that letter from David, down on his luck Walsh, landed in his mailbox, Felderhoff was in the same boat, out of work and out of money. That massive discovery in the 60s hadn't equated to riches for John Felderhoff because he hadn't owned a stake. The options he later held in other ventures, once worth tens of millions on paper, evaporated during the bust of the 80s. All Felderhoff had left was the shirt on his back, his reputation, and the theory that he wholeheartedly believed. Tectonomagmatism. "Tectono what?" Walsh sputtered after emptying his bank account to fly to Indonesia for a meeting with the geologist. "Yes," Felderhoff explained. "Gold and other precious metals are abundant where the Earth's fault lines intersect. The Pacific Ring of Fire, including Indonesia, was littered with collapsed volcanoes that have generated a massive buildup of heat and pressure, which have created miraculous treasures just waiting to be found." "Do you know of any available properties?" Walsh asked. "As a matter of fact, I do," Felderhoff replied. Deep in the dense, hilly jungles of Borneo, in East Kalimantan, near the Busang River, sat one of Earth's most abundant gold deposits. At least that's what John Felderhoff theorized. "Geologically, it's the most brilliant thing I've ever seen in my life," he said. "It's so big, it's scary. It's fucking scary." "Okay, well, why hadn't anyone mined Busang already?" "They had," Felderhoff said. "At least a dozen different companies had tried. But they drilled in the wrong places, with the wrong methods, the wrong tools, at the wrong depth. Geology wasn't on their minds," he later told Fortune magazine about the previous efforts. "They were spending all their time in town chasing girls and naming creeks after them," he quipped. David Walsh was sold. Back in Canada, he scraped together $80,000 by selling BreeX options and used it to buy a 90% stake in the mineral rights to roughly 475,000 acres near Busang from a cash-strapped Scottish owner. Walsh didn't have the capital to develop it either, yet, but that would be his primary role as president of the company, raise money from Calgary, and keep the operation afloat. The geology would be handled by John Felderhoff, Briex's new exploration manager, who remained in Indonesia and assembled a crew which consisted largely of Filipino geologists he had worked with on past projects, Michael De Guzman was put in charge. De Guzman was a gifted field man who shared Felderhoff's theories and, by most accounts, his arrogance, famously bragging that his IQ topped 150. He was the ideal man for the job. But the job would not pay well, at least initially. Salaries would be modest, but every Briex employee was offered the chance to buy company stock, which was trading for pennies on the Alberta Stock Exchange at the end of 1993, when the crew joined local villagers in a ritual sacrifice of a chicken to appease the spirits before drilling the first hole on their land. That first hole was a dud, and a second test hole was just as barren. "We almost closed the property," recalled Michael De Guzman. In December 1993, John said, "Close the property," and then we made the hit. A hit, was putting it mildly. A third, deeper core returned gold grades topping 6.5 grams per ton, more than 4 times the threshold considered economically promising. Anything above 1.5 grams per ton can justify a mine. Briex accelerated its drilling program to verify the strike, and by the end of January 1994, nearly 50 holes had been sunk. The results were extraordinary. Back in Canada, David Walsh was busy broadcasting Briex's stunning drill results to anyone who would listen. To bolster its credibility, the company stacked its board with retired mining executives and seasoned stock promoters and commissioned an independent review from respected geologists like Roger Pooley, who confirmed the findings. Each move added another layer of legitimacy. Soon, national brokerage houses were raising money on Briex's behalf, the financial press was buzzing, and by the end of 1994, the tiny Calgary junior miner was making serious waves, and those waves were only getting bigger. "Things are looking very, very good," John Felderhoff wrote to his boss. The latest drill results from Busang suggested 2 million ounces of recoverable gold. Briex's stock jumped to $2.84 a share when those numbers were made public. By the summer of 1995, Briex's already glowing projections nearly quadrupled. The company claimed Busang now contained 6 to 8 million ounces of gold. A penny stock just a year earlier, the company's share skyrocketed to nearly $15, and even seasoned analysts were convinced it was still undervalued. "After reviewing all the drill data and available cross-sections of Busang, we believe this project will develop into a world-class gold mining operation," wrote Egizio Bianchini of Nesbitt Burns. After touring the site, Bianchini estimated the deposit could contain as much as 62 million ounces. "I know for a fact the gold is there," he later told the Globe and Mail. "I've seen it."
Heading towards drill hole 96, the rock looks extremely favorable.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Mike, we're in good stuff here.
The stock surged with every new projection, and there seemed to be a new one every week. Briex's 1995 annual report claimed there were 40 million ounces of gold at the Busang property, doubling the company's valuation in days. By year's end, the estimate had ballooned to 100 million ounces, rivaling the world's largest gold mines. "When did you know you had hit the mother lode?" McLean's reporter Jennifer Wells asked John Felderhoff. He didn't hesitate. "Drill line 59 back in 95, he said. "That's when I called David and told him, we've got a monster by the tail." That monster was shattering records. Briex's stock graduated from the Alberta Stock Exchange to the NASDAQ, and then to the Toronto Stock Exchange, where it was added to elite indexes normally reserved for blue-chip institutional darlings. By May 1996, Briex shares peaked at $280 apiece. The company's market value topped $6.2 billion, and it had yet to produce a single ounce of gold.
Mr. Walsh, you are every prospector's, every penny stock promoter's dream come true. Do you have to at times still pinch yourself to believe that you found what you found?
I haven't had time to even think about it. Nothing's changed. The only thing's changed is I don't wear a tie anymore. No one can tell me to wear a tie.
The soaring price of Briex stock ignited a full-blown market frenzy. Investors were practically dancing in the Wall Streets and Bay Streets. Mutual funds, insurance companies, pension plans, and everyday people who had never owned a share of a company in their lives all piled in. The once obscure Calgary miner, was minting overnight millionaires like lottery ticket winnings. People poured every spare dollar into the stock. Some mortgaged their homes to buy more. Others borrowed against their own gains, doubling down on what looked like a sure thing. Bree X was proving everyone a genius.
But I heard of another tip too. Diamond stocks.
The most sensational tale came from St. Paul, Alberta, a prairie town of barely 5,000 people. A local credit union employee caught wind of Bree X early and shared the tip with family and friends. Many of them bought shares at just $2 a piece. 2 years later, the gamble paid off big. One in 50 residents of St. Paul had become a millionaire. I've earned enough from the stock to build a skyscraper, Jack Kinderman, an electrical contracting business owner, told the New York Times. If it doesn't work out, he chuckled, I just jump off.
Everyone's talking about Bree X, a small Calgary mining company that struck gold half a world away. And even though the mines are in Indonesia, a lot of the wealth is right here in St. Paul.
Bree X created a lot of wealth in Calgary too. CEO David Walsh cashed in a portion of his early shares, amassing a fortune rumored to be among the largest in Canada. To reassure jittery investors, Walsh emphasized that the sale represented only 3% of his holdings and that he remained the company's biggest shareholder. My desire to obtain full value for Bree X's stake in the Busang deposit, he wrote, is and will remain aligned with that of every other shareholder.
There was a quote in the news, in the magazine attributed to me when someone asked the same question, except they said, how many shares do I have? And I said, not enough, so.
John Felderhoff, meanwhile, sold nearly 500,000 shares that same year, pocketing around $24 million. Other executives quietly followed suit. Even Bree X itself sold off a chunk, raising $30 million to fund its expansion, which included a new Calgary office to replace the Walsh's basement headquarters. On the surface, it looked like smart business, but as the cash outs piled up, a darker question arose. Was this just prudent profit-taking, or did the men at the top know something the public didn't?
When I got this call, it was August, and the story didn't break until October the 4th, and we were frantically trying to get some evidence. If you just asked the company or presented it with them, they'd say, well, it's not true. What happened was the Indonesian government was not happy. This was a crummy little company. They wanted a big player. That was one thing, and the other thing was they had canceled, they had forced certain people in the mining, the mines ministry in Jakarta to cancel Bree X's exploration permit. This was key. You had a $6 billion company. It has one asset, one undeveloped mine site, and it's in really in the hands, and the government's pulling the plug. And no one knew this, so.
In late August 1996, just weeks after Bree X's meteoric stock price peaked, Douglas Gould, a business journalist at the Globe and Mail in Toronto, received an anonymous phone call. The hushed voice on the line claimed that the Indonesian government had recently revoked Bree X's exploration permit. In Indonesia, an exploration permit isn't just bureaucratic paperwork. It's the legal key to the treasure. Without it, there could be no mining. Without mining, no gold. And without gold, Bree X, then valued at $6 billion, was worthless. It was a bombshell. To make matters worse, such a permit required the personal signature of President Suharto, a man who ruled Indonesia like his private fiefdom. A former general who seized power in 1966, Suharto and his six children got a cut of every aspect of the nation's economy, oil, water, banking, even a doomed attempt at a national car. So imagine Suharto's reaction when he learned through international media that the largest gold deposit on earth had been found in his own backyard, and it belonged not to him or his cronies, but to a group of Canadians who bought the rights for relative pocket change.
I think that you have to play by their rules, and we've always taken the attitude that we're a guest in our country, and have tried to act accordingly to the best of our ability.
Indonesia welcomed foreign investment and industry, but there were certain rules that had to be adhered to, and Bree X had managed to break all of them. First, the company never received formal permission from the Indonesian government to purchase the Busang property. Second, it began drilling aggressively anyway. And third, it loudly promoted its results to the world before even briefing mining officials in Jakarta, in a country where nothing of consequence happened without presidential approval. Briex's behavior was tantamount to insult. A boomtown had sprung up around Busang, complete with power lines, roads, schools, a church, even glass windows, all without Suharto's blessing. That wouldn't stand. Citing a supposed ownership dispute with Briex's local partner, the president abruptly revoked the company's exploration permit in August 1996. After confirming the rumors, the Globe and Mail broke the story that October, and panic set in. Within hours, nearly $500 million was expunged from Briex's market value. The sell-off hit so hard that the Toronto Stock Exchange was forced to halt trading until David Walsh could issue a statement. When he did, he brushed it all aside. "Much ado about nothing," he said.
There was a lot of misinformation in the press. We tried to clarify it as best possible, but at no time did we not have tenure to the ground, which unfortunately was reported that we did, which dropped $500 million off our market capital. So I feel sorry for those shareholders, but...
David Walsh wasn't being honest. For months, Briex had publicly boasted of owning Busang outright. In reality, the company's exploration permit had been revoked, a fact he had known about for months but never disclosed. Now, backed into a corner, Walsh spun the story, claiming it had always been Briex's plan to bring in a production partner. In truth, partnership was the only way back into Jakarta's favor, and Suharto's government had already chosen the groom for Briex's shotgun marriage.
Barrick is the world's largest gold producer. We're geographically diverse with world-class assets on five continents. With an unwavering focus on delivering high-quality production, we're the lowest-cost senior gold producer, translating our strengths and results into higher shareholder returns.
Toronto-based Barrick Gold, founded by fedora-wearing tycoon Peter Munk, was the world's largest gold producer, with the money, muscle, and ambition to build a mine anywhere it pleased. And for months, its sights had been fixed squarely on Busang. Barrick's advisory board was stacked with political heavyweights, former U.S. senators, the chairman of Germany's central bank, and even two ex-heads of state, U.S. President George H.W. Bush and Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, both of whom personally lobbied the Indonesian government on Barrick's behalf. The company had also promised to partner with an operation owned by Suharto's daughter, Tutut, to construct the mine. Behind the scenes, Barrick's tactics were even slimier. Reports surfaced that the company had hired a private detection agency to dig up dirt on Briex by breaking into its offices and rummaging through David Walsh's garbage. Rival firms accused Barrick of playing dirty too. Vancouver's Placer Dome claimed the company sent anonymous faxes to Indonesian mining officials, dredging up its past environmental violations to knock it out of contention. And it worked. Briex announced that the Indonesian government had, quote, given guidance to partner with Barrick Gold on developing the Busang site. Under the proposed deal, Barrick would walk away with 75% of the project, leaving Briex with just 25%.
In Indonesia, it was a given that President Suharto and the government would receive a share. But Walsh also needed a partner to develop the mine. In stepped Peter Munk and his Canadian gold company, Barrick, who pushed right past Briex last fall and cut a deal directly with the government.
Briex wasn't about to take the hostile takeover lying down. In a last-ditch maneuver, the company announced a strategic alliance with Suharto's eldest son, Sagit, offering him a 10% stake in the mine. It was a costly gamble, but if it secured majority control and sped up government approval, Briex considered it money well spent. The effort, however, proved futile. The Wall Street Journal reported on November 27, 1996, that Barrick was poised to gain control of the massive Briex deposit. The Indonesian government set a December 4th deadline to finalize the deal, but when that date arrived, nothing happened. The negotiations had stalled. Neither side could agree to terms on how to split the world's greatest gold find. At the same time, President Suharto was getting cold feet. He was growing irritated with Barrick Gold's underhanded maneuvering, the infighting it had sparked among his children, and the flood of bad press that followed. Every headline in the U.S. and Canadian papers seemed to showcase the greed of Indonesia's first family. Yeah, of course corruption was the norm in this country, but can you foreigners not make it so obvious? Jeez. President Suharto turned to an old friend for guidance, Muhammad Bob Hassan, a Chinese Indonesian Muslim plywood tycoon, longtime confidant and golfing partner who had helped Suharto orchestrate his coup.
I've been friends with President Suharto for more than 40 years.
Hassan had a different recommendation. Why not Freeport MacMoran? The New Orleans-based mining giant had deeper roots in Indonesia than any other foreign company, and was conveniently the nation's largest corporate taxpayer. It already ran a massive operation in Papua, had offices in Jakarta, and knew how to navigate Indonesia's maze of rules and payoffs. Best of all, the government's long-standing partnership with Freeport meant it could keep a firm hand on the wheel, and on its larger-than-life CEO, Jim Bob Moffat, a brash, foul-mouthed Texan who reportedly moonlighted as an Elvis impersonator.
And all you can ever do in exploration is create the environment for a discovery. You can't ever assure it. If you ever meet anybody in the minerals business or the oil and gas business that tells you they got a cinch, you better run and hold your pocketbook.
In truth, Freeport hadn't been eager to touch the Bussain project. It already had its hands full with its own massive operations. But when Jakarta came calling, the company reluctantly agreed, if only to stay in Suharto's good graces. The deal was announced on February 17, 1997. Barrick was out, Jim Bob was in. Under the new arrangement, Briex would keep 45%, Freeport MacMoran would take 15%, and the remaining 40% would go to the Indonesian government and its local partners, half of which, unsurprisingly, belonged to Bob Hassan. The stock market hated the deal. Another $400 million was wiped from Briex's value overnight. Once again, David Walsh tried to soothe investors. This was the best deal possible, he insisted. Not only did they give Briex the largest share of ownership, but it also brought in the most experienced mining operator in Indonesia. That's a big comfort to us, he told reporters, though his tone suggested he was trying to convince himself as much as anyone else.
I'd call it a very nerve-wracking process, and we're all quite pleased at Briex that we feel we've come out with a great deal for the shareholders. I sit here today with a company that has 45% of probably the greatest gold discovery ever to be, certainly in history to date, and the cash flows from that will be astronomical.
Geologist John Felderhoff chimed in with a diplomatic response to the chaos. I think what happened here was we found too much gold, he said, so it becomes an issue of national interest. If we'd found a lot less, this would have never happened. Then, on that same conference call, Felderhoff doubled down with a new projection. Once we finish the drilling program we're currently doing, my estimate is 95 million ounces. Mike DeGuzman, my project manager, estimates 100 million. If you ask me what the total potential is, I'd feel very comfortable with 200 million ounces. 200 million ounces of gold, worth nearly $70 billion in 1997 dollars. And with the paperwork finally out of the way, there was just one thing left for Briex to do. Get it out of the ground.
The following is a paid advertisement for the Swindled Valued Listener Rewards Program.
Are you tired of hearing advertisements in Swindled like this one? Do you wish there was more Swindled content to distract you from your miserable existence? Don't settle for those other inferior podcasts with the annoying hosts who laugh at their own jokes. Become a Swindled Valued Listener today to receive easy access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that are not available anywhere else. Completely advertisement free. It's fun for the whole family, but don't take our word for it.
This is kind of embarrassing to admit, but I waited in line for 23 hours on Black Friday to get my Valued Listener membership. We did lose Grandma in a violent trampling, but it was so worth it because I also got a robot vacuum.
Millions of Swindled fans have discovered the secret of becoming a Valued Listener. Try it in your own home today. Also, act now to receive the Valued News for Valued Listeners update show at no extra cost. That's a $5,000 value for one easy monthly payment of $4.99.
Go to valuedlistener.com to sign up using Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Patreon. No long-term commitments, satisfaction guaranteed, foreign currency accepted. Cancel anytime. Please, just give us your money.
The PDAC is proud to recognize John Felderoff as this year's Prospector of the Year.
All the BRIEX big wigs were in Toronto on March 10, 1997, as John Felderoff accepted the Prospector of the Year award at the Prospectors and Developers Association's annual convention for his now world-famous Busang discovery. The celebration, however, ended abruptly when David Walsh's phone rang. "I hated to interrupt their joy," Freeport's Jim Bob Moffat later told Maclean's, "but I informed them they needed to get somebody back to the job site. We had run into difficulties." Back in Indonesia, Freeport McMoRan was conducting its own due diligence on the Busang property, as it would for any new acquisition. The company drilled 7 test holes beside BRIEX's supposedly rich cores, and what they found was alarming. Freeport's assays showed a fraction of the gold BRIEX had reported. Even worse, the drill samples themselves had visual discrepancies. Moffat was informed by his team that something was very wrong.
He said, "We've got our first 3 cores in, and there's insignificant gold." And so,
what did you say?
I said, "Well, that's an interesting development."
David Walsh's eyes glazed over as Jim Bob Moffat began rattling off the technical details. He passed the phone to John Felderoff, who insisted there had to be a mistake. To clear things up, Michael De Guzman, BRIEX's site manager, was sent back to Indonesia to investigate. It was almost a 4-day wait, Moffat later recalled, and then he never arrived at all. Michael De Guzman had reportedly been planning a romantic getaway to Niagara Falls with an exotic dancer he had recently met when the call came ordering him back to Busang. Before boarding his flight, the 41-year-old geologist allegedly proposed to her, despite already being married to 4, possibly 5 different women in at least 3 different countries. The trip took De Guzman from Toronto to Anchorage to Hong Kong and then Singapore, where he further delayed the journey for a medical checkup. De Guzman was battling malaria and hepatitis B, ailments that had dogged him for years in the field. After receiving encouraging health news, Michael De Guzman finally landed in Indonesia on March 18, 1997. He spent the night in Balikpapan, where he met up with fellow BRIEX employee Rudy Vega. They got drunk at a karaoke bar where De Guzman sang Frank Sinatra's My Way. The next morning, De Guzman and Vega showed up nearly half an hour late for their chartered helicopter flight to Samarinda, the final stop before Busang. Mike had to make a pit stop to buy new clothes because he woke up soaking wet. He told Rudy he had fallen asleep in the bathtub after drinking an entire bottle of cough medicine. "Again?" Vega asked in astonishment. 20 minutes later, the helicopter touched down in Samarinda, where the two men went their separate ways. De Guzman would continue on to Busang to sort out the discrepancies with Freeport. After a long layover, he boarded another chopper with 3 bags in tow and took a seat in the back, an unusual choice for a solitary passenger. They lifted off around 10:30 a.m. 17 minutes into the flight, at roughly 800 feet, the pilot heard a sharp pop and felt a rush of air. He turned to see the cabin door flung open and the rear seat empty. The headset lay dangling, ripped from its jack. Michael De Guzman had jumped into the dense jungle below. After circling the area for 25 minutes without seeing any signs of life, the pilot finally turned back to the airfield and reported the incident to authorities. The bags De Guzman left behind offered limited clues. 2 sets of handwritten suicide notes addressed to his first wife, his children, and to John Felderoff and friends. "Sorry, I have to leave. I cannot think of myself as a carrier of hepatitis B. God bless you all. No more stomach pains. No more back pains." Even stranger, among the papers was a letter granting full control of his estate to a BRIEX accountant, a man he had never even met. A search and rescue team of more than 100 people began scouring the jungle 2 days after De Guzman reportedly jumped. 3 days into the recovery, 2 BRIEX workers followed a foul stench through the swamp and found a body. face down, half submerged, crawling with maggots and leeches. The clothes matched De Guzman's, but little else did. His face was smashed in and unrecognizable. His hair had disappeared. Wild boars had eaten parts of his body, including his buttocks and genitals. To add insult to injury, when the corpse was airlifted out of the jungle, it was somehow dropped from 8 feet onto the tarmac, further pulverizing the dead man into a bag of broken bones. An autopsy performed in Indonesia positively identified the body as Michael De Guzman using dental records and personal items, but could not determine a cause of death because of advanced decomposition. The medical examiner did note, however, that all of his internal organs were missing, which was interesting. Official reports concluded that it was a suicide, but De Guzman's family did not believe it. They turned to Jerome Bailan, an anthropologist with the Philippine Forensic Group, often described as the Sherlock Holmes of the Philippines. Bailan was convinced that the body was indeed Michael De Guzman's, but the circumstances were far from clear. The injuries didn't match those typically seen in high falls, and medical experts confirmed that De Guzman's illnesses weren't severe enough to drive someone to kill themselves. In fact, just days earlier, the geologist bought new clothes, made plans with Indonesian wife number 4, and scheduled meetings at work. Then came another odd detail. In his supposed suicide notes, De Guzman misspelled his first Filipino wife's name. Bailan theorized that maybe the letters were written under duress. Perhaps he was kidnapped, tortured, partially scalped, strangled, and dumped, as the injuries, delayed search, and relatively young maggots on his corpse seemed to suggest. This conclusion was shared by several others who had investigated the case, including the bushman of the Shuswap, John Bjornstrom, and Diane Francis, the editor of Canada's Financial Post newspaper and author of Brie X, The Inside Story.
For instance, I've discovered that Mr. De Guzman was abducted in February and held captive for 5 days as a hostage by certain Indonesian people. We don't know exactly whom and what transpired during that abduction.
Another curious detail, the pilot on De Guzman's final flight wasn't the usual charter pilot Brie X employees knew, but an active member of the Indonesian Air Force. That alone was enough to stir whispers. Then came the reminder of a mysterious fire 2 months earlier at De Guzman's Busang office, one that had conveniently destroyed geological records and key files. At the time, it was dismissed as an accident. Now, it looked far more deliberate. Even more ominous, De Guzman's mother told investigators that just weeks before his supposed suicide, her son had called her in distress and pleaded, "Pray for me. They want to kill me."
What I really suspect is that Mr. De Guzman's death, which is being billed by the Indonesian police as a suicide, is actually a murder.
But that wasn't the only theory. Others believed Michael De Guzman had faked his death and had vanished with his Brie X fortune to live out his days in anonymous luxury. After all, secrecy was second nature to him. This was a man who kept multiple passports, identities, and wives, none of whom knew about the others. Adding to the mystery, John Macbeth, a veteran journalist with the Straits Times, Singapore's most influential English-language newspaper, reported that a corpse had gone missing from the morgue in the very town where De Guzman's helicopter had taken off. Had Michael dressed the body in his new clothes and arranged for it to be dumped in the jungle? That theory would explain the disfiguring injuries and even the missing penis. Rumors suggested that the body from the morgue had been uncircumcised, while most Filipino men typically are. Don't ask me how I know. The pseudocide theory refused to die. Over the years, alleged De Guzman sightings cropped up in Canada, Malta, Brazil, and the Bahamas. Most intriguingly, Macbeth reported that De Guzman's second widow claimed she had received tens of thousands of dollars wired from an overseas bank account, though this was never verified. Quote, "Jeannie De Guzman never produced any proof of the money transfer and has since gone silent, leaving us to ponder the same old questions all over again." However, within days of Michael De Guzman's death, a far more plausible theory and motive had emerged, one that worked for every scenario, murder, suicide, or a carefully planned escape. Every pulled thread led back to the same source, the motherlode at Busang, or the lack thereof.
Deep in the heart of Kalimantan on the island of Borneo, a mystery is unfolding. It involves a gold mine, an unexplained death, and the fate of millions of dollars worth of investment.
On March 21, 1997, an obscure Indonesian newspaper ran a brief 10-paragraph story about BRIEX, based, it claimed, on information from someone close to the operation. Buried in the piece was an explosive revelation. Quote, "It is possible that the deposit is not as big as mentioned before. It could be that it is not viable to mine the deposit." As the story rippled across the internet, BRIEX shares plunged 13% in a single day. The Toronto Stock Exchange once again halted trading to stave off a full-blown panic and give David Walsh and company time to respond to the rumors. Completely unsubstantiated, David Walsh declared in a press release. Freeport, he insisted, had not released any official drill results, and BRIEX maintained absolute confidence in the integrity of the data it had been reporting since 1993. Walsh even threatened legal action against those spreading misinformation, blaming them for, quote, "the erosion of share value which has resulted." "There are very heavy forces trying to discredit us," Walsh told reporters in a separate interview. "I am 120% confident that gold is there. There's just been a colossal screw-up somewhere." Then, with trademark bravado, he added, "Unfortunately, when the first ounce of gold is poured at Busang, I'm sure the naysayers will complain about the color."
What are you going to say, Mr. Walsh?
I think our press release says it all for now.
David Walsh was bluffing, and he knew it. He'd already been told that almost no gold had been found. While Freeport publicly downplayed the rumors as a mere miscommunication, behind the scenes, Jim Bob Moffat was losing his temper. "We had a good idea where this bastard was headed," Moffat later said. "We were doing due diligence and needed the BRIEX people to come up and look at the data, but we couldn't get anyone to show up. They send a Guzman and the poor sumbitch disappears, whatever happened to him. I was so pissed off I could eat dirt." Before going public with its findings, Freeport gave David Walsh one last chance to save face. He was invited to hire an independent firm to verify the results. Strathcona Mineral Services, a respected Toronto-based consultancy, was brought in to conduct its own drilling program, a process expected to take about 4 weeks. In the meantime, Strathcona would comb through Freeport's due diligence data and BRIEX's earlier feasibility studies, hoping to uncover where exactly there was a disconnect. Strathcona reached a preliminary conclusion within days of arriving in Indonesia. This is Graham Farquharson, the company's co-founder, who led the audit.
"We had a pretty good idea, based on all the red flags that we had seen, that there couldn't possibly be something there. And so we were not losing any sleep at night worrying about what the results would be from our own drilling. We pretty well knew that they were going to come back with no gold."
Farquharson felt a moral duty to alert the public as soon as possible. "We didn't want to have widows buying the stock while we were sitting on this kind of news," he later explained. Before breaking the story, he phoned his contact at BRIEX, a courtesy call, to warn them about the storm that was going to hit the following day. The announcement was made at 10:30 a.m. on March 26, 1997. "Based on the work done by Freeport and our own review and observations to date, there appears to be a strong possibility that the potential gold resources of the Busang property have been overstated because of invalid samples and assaying."
A receptionist inside struggled to handle all the calls, but there was no sign of BRIEX president David Walsh, just this terse news release with an astounding announcement. "There appears to be a strong possibility that the potential gold resources on the Busang project have been overstated because of invalid samples."
Not just overstated, but insignificant, meaning there was nothing there. Despite BRIEX's frantic attempts at damage control, dismissing Strathcona and Freeport's findings as merely preliminary, panic spread instantly. Within 30 minutes of the opening bell, 7.9 million shares of BRIEX had changed hands. The Toronto Stock Exchange's computers crashed twice under the volume. By day's end, BRIEX had lost 80% of its value, over $3 billion in market capitalization, destroyed within minutes.
I don't know who's responsible or where the mistakes are made, but I think it's all over. I think that my shares are worthless.
That afternoon, David Walsh hastily convened a press conference on the steps of BRIEX's Calgary office. "Like all the other trials and tribulations we've faced since discovering this project," he declared, we'll be exonerated and the property will stand as we've indicated. Walsh spoke with the confidence of a man who still believes Strathcona's drills would prove his geologist right. He wasn't alone in his denial. Egizio Bianchini, the bullish Canadian gold analyst who had championed Briex, dismissed the report as preposterous, while online investors rejoiced at the opportunity to buy more Briex shares at bargain basement prices before it skyrocketed again. And in St. Paul, Alberta, local shareholder Jack Kinderman, who had once threatened to leap off a skyscraper if the stock tanked, told the Wall Street Journal, "There's nothing wrong with Briex, mark my words." Many investors were certain this was just another twist in a vast conspiracy. The Indonesian government, they insisted, had staged the bad test results to seize the mine for itself, with Freeport undoubtedly in on the plot. Others swore it was the Filipino mafia manipulating the stock for profit before silencing Michael De Guzman to cover their tracks. And to some, the most obvious culprit of all was the Americans. You knew they just couldn't let the Canadians have anything.
It just sounds like a big scam.
Well, I don't think he committed suicide, the geologist. That's my theory on that part of it.
But I don't think somebody could go for 3 years and fool the whole world. And it's just not possible.
Okay.
So I believe in Briex.
Well, I think there's been a conspiracy, not so much by the Briex management, but by the assay office in the Philippines.
I can't imagine that, first of all, they would allow this to happen, and the bad name is going to give Canada all over the world. And I hope that the Americans are really saying all of this to reduce the price of the stock so that they can get it cheaper.
Maybe a consortium as opposed to a full-blown conspiracy. It just seems that anything this big, this fast, this pronounced, that's not American, gets the heck beat out of it, if you know what I mean.
The cold, hard truth was this. Briex was a fraud, engineered from within the company from day one. Strathcona Mineral Services confirmed as much on May 4th, 1997, after completing its drilling test program. Its 150-page report, delivered to David Walsh's desk, began bluntly, "We very much regret having to express the firm opinion that an economic gold deposit has not been identified in the southeast zone of the Busang property and is unlikely to be. We realize that the conclusions reached in this interim report will be a great disappointment to the many investors, employees, suppliers, and the joint venture partners associated with Briex, to the government of Indonesia, and to the mining industry everywhere. However, the magnitude of tampering with core samples that we believe has occurred and the resulting falsification of assay values at Busang is of a scale and over a period of time and with a precision that, to our knowledge, is without precedent in the history of mining anywhere in the world." Now came the inevitable reckoning, the same questions that surface in every great scandal. Who knew what and when?
Mr. Walsh, are you criminal?
Who are you hiring to investigate this?
It's been in the press, if you knew.
It was chaos in front of the Briex office in Calgary today, as once again David Walsh, the rags-to-riches promoter and president of the company, brushed by reporters. Stock markets across North America refused to allow trading in the shares of the company, as it now stands accused of the biggest and most sophisticated scam ever perpetrated in the history of mining.
It's remarkable how simple it is to create billions in shareholder value. All it takes is a stage, a spotlight, and a promise of driverless cars, of flights to Mars, of a healthcare revolution with nothing more than a prick of a finger. Or if you prefer the old-fashioned way, you could buy a cheap piece of property, sprinkle a little gold dust on some worthless rocks, and call it the find of the century. According to Graham Farquharson at Strathcona Minerals, that was precisely Briex's approach. At its Busang camp, the core samples were crushed on site before being sent for quality testing, a highly irregular practice in the mining world. Even stranger, the entire samples were destroyed in the process, leaving nothing behind for verification. In legitimate operations, half of each core is typically preserved for cross-checking to confirm laboratory results. Somewhere between the crushing at Busing and delivery to the independent lab, Strathcona determined the samples had been salted, meaning tiny flakes of gold from an outside source had been mixed in to make the pulverized rock appear as if it had been pulled from a rich deposit. On closer analysis, the deception became obvious. The gold particles in Briex's samples were rounded, as if they'd been shaved off jewelry or panned from a riverbed, not angular and embedded in quartz as they would be in a natural ore.
Clearly indicates that the samples were tampered with, that the gold that was in Briex's own samples was introduced from a foreign source.
Strathcona estimated that as many as 30,000 ore samples from Briex's Busing operation had been altered, including the ones provided the third-party analyst who confirmed the results. It was the simplest, yet most elaborate fraud in the history of mining. "It's the oldest game in town, ladies and gentlemen," Jim Bob Moffat told McLean's, "but I've never seen a fraud on this scale."
The crush rock was carried in plastic bags like this. Today, a big American miner who almost unknowingly got sucked into this venture told us a single salt shaker-sized batch of gold dust sprinkled precisely into these bags, thousands of them on the road or on the river over the course of the 3 years, would have been enough to pull off this scheme.
The Strathcona report meticulously detailed how the fraud had been carried out, but stopped short of naming names. Still, all evidence pointed in one direction: the Busing site manager, who personally inspected every sample bag before it left for assay, Michael Antonio de Guzman. Subsequent investigations all but confirmed him as the architect of the scam. Over 2.5 years, de Guzman reportedly purchased around 60 ounces of panned gold from the Indonesian locals, ground it into fine powder, and salted the core samples, sometimes right on the Busing camp's pool table before shipping them off for testing. Douglas Gold, Globe and Mail journalist and co-author of the Briex fraud, believes Michael de Guzman knew the walls were closing in. When Freeport uncovered the truth, Gold suspects, de Guzman took desperate measures to escape the fallout.
"I think there's absolutely no question that he jumped. I think there's absolutely no question that he is the main person behind this, but probably not the only person behind it, and that he realized that the jig was up."
That was the next question. Had Michael de Guzman acted alone? Most doubted it. He managed several exploration sites across Indonesia and was constantly on the move. And given the sheer volume of samples coming out of Busing, there almost certainly had to be accomplices. Strathcona concluded it could have been as few as 2 or 3 individuals. The most likely suspects were de Guzman's trusted Filipino geologists, the ones he compensated and rewarded most generously. But when Briex collapsed, those men vanished without a trace. Reporters, investigators, everyone who tried to find them came up empty. The Wall Street Journal, however, eventually tracked down Cesar Puspos, de Guzman's right-hand man, who insisted he had no idea how the salting could have occurred, even though he himself had approved many of the samples for shipment.
NBC News in depth tonight, what is emerging as one of the biggest financial scams in history. A company called Briex Minerals claimed to have found a massive gold mine in a country is located in a chain of islands that make up Indonesia called Borneo.
"This is the biggest scandal that's ever hit this industry.
Maybe worth $70 billion, its Canadian developers said. But in the last few days, it's become clear it wasn't even fool's gold."
Fool's gold, a story of fraud, mysterious death, and greed.
There was not 3 million ounces, there was not 30 million, there was not 40 million, there was not 71 million, which was the last official estimate. There was nothing there. Zero. Nada.
This was an orchestrated fraud.
But it is essentially a perfect swindle.
The gold mine was a complete fraud. As a result, Briex stock, which had gone as high as $210 a share recently, was trading at 4.5 cents a share today.
As usual, the road to riches had been littered with red flags, ignored, dismissed, or drowned out by greed and hysteria. There were the absurd gold projections that ballooned to $70 billion, the sloppy chain of custody that flouted every mining best practice, the veil of secrecy surrounding Briex's undisclosed properties and restricted access, the mysterious fire that destroyed records, the suspicious death of Michael de Guzman, the checkered past of John Felderhoff, the dumb luck of David Walsh. Taken together, who in their right mind could have believed it? Almost everyone, apparently. In the days that followed, as the market erased what little value Briex had left, the most powerful players scrambled to wipe the egg from their faces. Canada's mining sector, once a point of national pride, had become an international joke. Regulators rushed to impose new reporting standards and quality controls, desperate to prove they had learned something from the humiliation. The investment advisors who once promised limitless riches suddenly claimed to be victims themselves, blindsided not by deceit but by their own absence of common sense. The Toronto Stock Exchange was no less complicit. By listing Briex and stuffing it into major indexes, it helped funnel billions of ordinary dollars into the illusion. Some of the country's largest institutional investors took staggering losses. The Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan alone was out $100 million. But no one suffered more than the average Joe.
Across Canada and the United States, people lost millions of dollars. People like investor George Diekmeyer.
Three-quarters of my assets are $250,000, on which I count to make a living from.
Of Briex's 240 million outstanding shares, nearly 70% were owned by ordinary investors, and for many of them, the only thing left in their hands was the empty bag they had been sold. Ordinary investors like 78-year-old retired accountant George Diekmeyer, who had staked nearly everything he owned on Briex and lost it all. But the loss ran deeper than dollars. The stockbroker who had urged him to buy in, a longtime friend, Pierre Turgeon, was so consumed by guilt that he leapt to his death from his seventh-floor apartment.
This was extremely difficult because, to some extent, I felt maybe I was responsible too for his demise.
Lawrence Beadle, a 62-year-old lawyer in New Westminster, BC, lost $3 million when the gold stock collapsed. It's just fate, just bad luck, his wife consoled him. We will make everything right again. But when Beadle's wife walked into his office to answer the phone on April 7, 1997, she found her husband slumped over in his chair with a gunshot wound in his head. Stories of ruin like these fueled a wave of outrage and up to 8 class action lawsuits in the aftermath. Investors from New York to Vancouver, from Texas to Toronto, accused Briex of issuing false statements about its supposed gold reserves, while insiders quietly cashed out. And it wasn't just the company or its executives in the crosshairs. The lawsuits named everyone who had helped legitimize the illusion. Geological consultants, investment bankers, financial advisors, and analysts, even the stock exchanges themselves. Most of the plaintiffs understood that recovering any of the billions lost on paper was a pipe dream. Where would the money even come from? The lucky few who sold early. Briex was already bankrupt. At a minimum, shareholders wanted accountability, especially after the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's Commercial Crime Unit announced in May 1999 that it would not pursue criminal charges. The fraud was too sprawling, too costly, too complex to untangle, it claimed. The witnesses were scattered across the globe, and the evidence, like the gold, had disappeared.
It is probably the biggest stock fraud in Canadian history, but that is no guarantee that anyone will be going to jail. In fact, the RCMP announced today that it will not be laying charges in the Briex swindle.
What about David Walsh? Shouldn't he have been held responsible for overseeing the entire thing? Not quite. Every investigation, all of which the former Briex CEO cooperated with, concluded that Walsh was less a mastermind than a mark. He had spent little time in Indonesia and played almost no role in the actual mining operations. Yes, he sold tens of millions of dollars worth of stock, but never at the peak. And when the House of Cards collapsed, David was still its biggest shareholder, losing more money than anyone else. If David Walsh was guilty of anything, it wasn't fraud, it was faith. Blind, costly faith in the people around him. A failure to ask questions that mattered. And even if prosecutors had found a way to make charges stick, his punishment would have been brief. Walsh dropped dead from a brain aneurysm at his home in the Bahamas on June 4, 1998, a little more than a year after the collapse of Briex.
As you've heard on the news throughout the morning, the founder and chairman of Briex Minerals, David Walsh, died yesterday at the age of 52. His life ended in disgrace.
What about John Felderhoff, Briex's exploration manager? Surely he had to have known. Not according to him. Felderhoff released a statement from his home in the Grand Caymans after the scheme was exposed. "Let me state categorically again that I did not participate in any tampering. I was not aware of any tampering with the Busing core samples, and I believe that the systems and personnel in place at Busing were adequate to detect tampering." Felderhoff was quick to remind everyone that he, too, had been left holding a mountain of worthless BRIAX stock. He had cooperated with Strathcona's audit, hired reputable labs and consultants, and even sent his own son to work at the Busing site, something he would not have done, he says, if he suspected anything was amiss. In the end, Felderhoff's defense boiled down to two possibilities. Either he was lying through his nicotine-stained teeth, or he was utterly incompetent. Neither, as it turned out, was particularly flattering. This is Andrew Willis, the co-author of the BRIAX fraud.
John Felderhoff was the chief geologist. He was in Indonesia. His name is all over the scientific work. If he did not know, he should have known. He was incompetent, because he ultimately was very much responsible for those day-to-day operations.
The Ontario Securities Commission suspected the same.
This is the man who may have to answer for the biggest fraud in mining history, John Felderhoff. Felderhoff is one of the top officers of BRIAX.
On May 11, 1999, the Ontario Securities Commission charged John Felderhoff, the last senior BRIAX executive left standing, with 8 quasi-criminal offenses, including insider trading and approving misleading press releases. In theory, a conviction could have led to prison time. But unlike true criminal charges, these carried no extradition power. Felderhoff could simply stay beyond reach, and for the most part, he did. The case dragged on for 6 years, built largely on the mountain of red flags Felderhoff claimed to have somehow missed. Proceedings were repeatedly delayed as the OSC tried and failed to have the judge removed for alleged bias after he tolerated the defense lawyer's combative style. Finally, on July 21, 2007, the verdict arrived. John Felderhoff was acquitted on all charges. In his ruling, the judge described the fraud as unprecedented, adding, "The mining industry did not suspect that such sophisticated tampering on such a scale could occur and was not actively looking for it." The decision was a bittersweet victory for the 67-year-old John Felderhoff. Despite racking up an estimated $75 million through the sale of BRIAX shares, the lengthy litigation and a long divorce left him virtually broke again. To make matters worse, Felderhoff was never able to return to mining. He had been blacklisted from the industry to which he had dedicated his life. No reputable company would touch him. Still, he refused to let go of the one symbol of his former glory, his 1996 Prospector of the Year award, even after officials politely asked him to return it. John Felderhoff spent his final years in the Philippines, running a small convenience store from the home he shared with his new wife. In a rare 2012 interview with the Northern Miner, he reflected on his time at BRIAX, claiming he knew exactly who was responsible but refused to say their names aloud. Two things, however, he maintained with absolute certainty. Michael de Guzman was innocent, he said, and the hills of Busing still held gold waiting to be mined.
Today, a judge did the same. He ruled that after 16 years of litigation, there's no reason to continue. No more money to recover. Tens of thousands of investors were bilked out of billions of dollars. They'll share a mere $5.2 million, a pittance.
The largest fraud in Canadian history goes without any accountability.
Swindled is written, researched, produced, and hosted by me, a concerned citizen, with original music by Trevor Howard, aka Deformer, aka the Bushman of Southern California. For more information about Swindled, you can visit swindledpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Swindled Podcast. Or you can send us a postcard at P.O. Box 2045, Austin, Texas 78768, but please, no packages. We do not trust you. Swindled is a completely independent production, which means no network, no investors, no bosses, no shadowy money men, no salting. We plan to keep it that way, but we need your support. Become a valued listener on Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify at valuedlistener.com. For as little as $5 a month, You will receive early access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that you can't find anywhere else. And everything is 100% commercial free. Become a valued listener at valuedlistener.com. Or if you want to support the show and need something to wear to marry your fourth wife, consider buying something you don't need at swindledpodcast.com/shop. There are t-shirts, patches, hats, hoodies, posters, coffee mugs, and more. swindledpodcast.com/shop. And remember to use coupon code CAPITALISM to receive 10% off your order. If you don't want anything in return for your support, you can always simply donate using the form on the homepage. That's it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Sarah from Lloydminster, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Hey, my name's Autumn. I am located in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada.
My name is Melissa from Calgary, Alberta. And I am an answered citizen and a valued listener.
I trust no one.
I love shit like this that's messy when it doesn't involve me.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.